Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thank you so much for joining us again. This week's guest is Marissa Wojcik, who grew up in Chicago, but has lived in various places across the United States, where she's soaked up experiences, flavors, and inspirations that have formed who she is as a recipe creator and a food blogger. Marissa and I talk about everything from honoring the traditions of our cultures to finding and growing a community of supporters in the virtual space. So sit back, enjoy the conversation, and let's dish. Welcome, Marissa Wojcik, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thanks so much for spending time with me today. How is everything going on your coast?
It's been cold. It's this morning I woke up, it was in the 40s. So
the 40s are cold for you. Meanwhile, here, this is like our balmy, this is unseasonably warm for this time of year for us at the time of this recording. It's still early in the year. We're not sure yet if we're still kind of hanging on the ends of the fall season. Are we yet coming into winter? Are we starting in early spring? Who can tell? Nobody knows. Marissa, let's go and share with the listeners, you and I were just talking about this because it's the first time that you and I have met, mm-hmm. as to where we know each other. I mean, I found you on Instagram and you shared with me a little bit about how you found me. And would you like to share with our listeners that backstory?
Yeah. So I actually found you through the Food Memory Project, who was just in the last episode that was released. We kind of started talking really early on in COVID over Instagram, and became pretty quick Instagram friends. And I actually was one of the first few people who wrote a story for them. And I saw them post that they had been on this podcast, and that sent me down a deep dive into the podcast. And here we are.
First of all, the power of social media, right? We just talked about how sometimes it has a lot of negative cons to it, but then there's also this ability to really bring all of these worlds together. It's making this larger global scale a little bit smaller, and especially being able to, in weirdly, the way that whatever the algorithms are set up, in finding people who reflect our missions and our thoughts and our beliefs, and really ending up putting us together with people we might not have ever come across. So what Marissa's talking about is the episode with Sarah and Lisa Listen, the mother and daughter duo who run, their creators and founders of the Food Memory Project. And that was on the January 17th episode, if I'm not mistaken, 2023, the kicking off my season 5. So just if you share with me whatever you listened to, were there certain things that you were more drawn to, or did you not go down that deep as far as listening to the podcast or learning a little bit more about my neck of the woods? Because I do a variety of things, as I'm sure a lot of my guests do. So yeah. Was there anything that kind of struck your fancy or that you felt connection to?
You know, I think especially with the Food Memory Project episode, the continuation of tradition is something, you know, being Jewish, that's something we think about a lot. And kind of just the through line of that through a lot of the episodes, just it fascinated me. It's, you know, it kind of talks to, no matter what culture, there's always traditions that are being brought in, especially around food. And my background's in history. I'm a history major. And I love studying just those through lines and how food has kind of evolved or not evolved through generations. You know, there are still people making the same recipes that their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents have made. And that, to me, is fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah. So take us a little then back in your life, in your memories. What are some of the first things that you remember of being a kid and growing up in the Jewish faith, in the tradition of, I'm not sure, were you raised kosher, not kosher? Share with us a little bit about those memories and those celebrations and whatever else kind of sticks with you now, and then we'll jump ahead and talk about where you are now.
So I was not raised kosher. The one rule in our house was no pork. And that's kind of, you know, my mom from, I mean, the time I was little, I can never remember a time we had pork in the house. But that was it. We would mix milk and meat and, you know, I grew up Reform. So really, you know, I don't think they call it this anymore, but they used to call it the pick and choose denomination of Judaism. And it was great. It was, you know, a really warm upbringing. There, you know, there's a joke in Judaism that all of our holidays are, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. So, you know, obviously food is very central to a lot of Jewish holidays. But that being said, you know, my earliest memories are really, they're kind of juxtaposing each other. There's, you know, my coming home, my mom was a fantastic baker. So I remember coming home in the winter. I grew up in Chicago. It was, you know, always freezing. And knowing that she had made cookies for us after school because the windows were fogged and you could see that, you know, the oven had been on. And then, you know, also going, my mom's parents, my grandma's a fantastic cook. We would go for Sunday night dinners a lot. And, you know, she would make kind of older recipes that, you know, her mom would make or things like that. We have one chicken recipe that's kind of like an oven fried chicken in our family. We call it Grandma Frida's chicken because that was my grandma's mom, was Grandma Frida, and she came up with this recipe. And then on the other side, you know, my dad's parents, I was lucky in the fact I grew up really close to all four of my grandparents. And, you know, I remember going to my dad's parents after Sunday school and we'd, you know, pick up Kentucky Fried Chicken and go watch the Bears game. And so, you know, there's something so nostalgic about Kentucky Fried Chicken also, which is totally not a Jewish food, but it has that, you know, from my mom's side, we have the oven fried chicken, and then Kentucky Fried Chicken on my dad's side has the same kind of memories. So it's juxtaposing, but it's also this through line, right? Of, you know, similarities.
That's really interesting to me because in our family, well, first of all, I did not know my paternal grandparents. They lived in Italy and died before I ever got to go visit them. So I didn't get to sample my grandma's cooking in that respect, but I'm sure she made some fantastic food. And then we actually lived in a two-family home with my maternal grandparents, and that's where I would go also for Sunday dinners. I would actually go and help with, you know, at the tender age of whatever, 6, 10, 11, where I would go and help cook and make that feast because we always had our cousins coming in. Anyway, my point was that being Italian, my parents were very opposed to eating any kind of outside foods that was even remotely close to pasta dinner. So I'm really interested and fascinating to know, like, how did that like get allowed? Like, you were allowed to kind of cheat on your grandma's, you know, chicken recipe with Kentucky Fried, sacrilege as far as I would have was brought up. So did you have any kind of, you know, who made it best, who wore it best type of deals when it came to that or no?
You know, it was two sets of grandparents. So it wasn't really, there wasn't any like, you know, who made it best really. It was
no competition.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting because my mom's parents are both Jewish. Both families came over before the Holocaust from Russia in like the late 1800s. And then on my dad's side, his mom is Jewish and she's a Holocaust survivor. And then my grandfather is Polish Catholic and has been in Chicago for ever, his family. And so it's, there's, you know, on one side, there's this very, very, very strong Jewish tradition. And on the other side, it's this melding of cultures. And it's, you know, to me, it was like, okay, this is what it is to be American. And like, what's more American than Kentucky Fried Chicken?
Absolutely. And I love that too, because you got to sample outside foods. You were able to, you know, in the quote unquote fast food world, but it was also giving you that experience of going outside and tasting the flavors out there. And so that it wasn't just homemade foods and that's it. Were you an early cooker and recipe maker as well, you know, from just being in the kitchen with all those people? Or did it take a while into your more independent adult years before you kind of got your own bearings in the kitchen and how to create or make any kind of recipes yourself?
I honestly couldn't even tell you when I started baking because I think I was so young when my mom would, you know, hand me the beaters and say, all right, we're making cookies or cupcakes. And so I've always been really, really comfortable in the kitchen. In terms of creating recipes, that definitely was something that came later. Like, I was the kid who would come home from school. Rachel Ray was on at 3:30, and I would sit in front of the TV and watch her make, it was her 30-minute meals or whatever her old show used to be. And I would sit for hours and watch her make food and just absorb everything. And so it took a really long time to kind of understand the ways of cooking and the different, you know, the different things you could do and what flavors go together. And, you know, I think it took a long time to really build confidence enough to say, okay, I have something to share with the world. And honestly, it wasn't really wasn't until my husband said, you know, you should make a blog, you should put this out there. And I was like, who's going to want to, why? Like, no one's going to want to read this. And it's been, I mean, it's been incredible, especially during COVID, just the community that, you know, found online and through social media, and especially, you know, in the Jewish community as well, it really connected me to my religion and my culture when in a time when we couldn't be together. And, you know, Judaism is such a communal religion that it was really hard not to be in a synagogue or not to, you know, go out with a young adult group. And it was just this connector. And it also brought me to people I would have never met, like Food Memory Project. I mean, I think, you know, they're from North Carolina. Like, I've never been to North Carolina.
Creating and recreating of recipes that were handed down, or at least, you know, you were able to mimic by watching and learning, mm-hmm. and that hands-on approach. And then also talking too about savory versus sweet. We've said this too in some of the previous episodes, that there could be a fearlessness when it comes to developing our own recipes or recreating something or wanting to start from scratch and doing our own thing when it comes to savory foods, because you can't really mess it up too bad unless you're putting in like cinnamon with garlic. And I haven't really tasted that yet to know for sure if that would not be the greatest combination, but I can guess. Versus a baking recipe where that is a science, and if you accidentally put in too much flour or too much egg or not enough of, you know, something or other, vanilla extract, whatever you have, the whole taste texture can be completely thrown off. So where did you see yourself being a little bit stronger? Was it the recreation and development of the tried and true, or allowing yourself that flexibility and freedom and gaining momentum, or tying the two together? Like, as you got a little bit more familiar in the kitchen, are you more of a savory cook or a baker?
The answer is both. you know, I started the blog with a challah of the week category. And so challah, for anyone who doesn't know, is a Jewish bread. We make it for Shabbat, which is, you know, our day of rest. It's Friday night to Saturday night. And it's typically, it's pretty similar to a brioche almost. It's an egg bread. It's not an enriched dough like brioches, so it's a little easier to make. But I really, you know, it's such a plain canvas that I thought, okay, let me see what I can add to this. And so, and it can go either way. It can be savory or sweet. And so I really started playing around with, especially during COVID, no one could travel during those early days. And so I did an around the world challah series where I took flavors from other countries and put them in the challah. And, you know, that was really, really fun. I made, my favorite one that I made was, and it's not true challah dough, but it was bao dough stuffed with vegetables and braided into the shape of challah. And it was so fun because I don't cook with Asian flavors a lot. And it was so fun to experiment and to figure out, okay, this dough is similar, but it's not the same. We have to steam it, not bake it. And it's all like a puzzle. And that's what's fun to me. And I'm very not science-minded. Like, I had to take chemistry twice in college, like not science-minded. And so it is kind of this, for some reason, all of the science just makes sense to me when I'm in the kitchen. And then on the sweet side, you know, it's really understanding just how the ingredients work together and knowing the methods behind it. So like, you know, if you're making cookies, I can't even tell you how many days this year trying to make like those thin, chewy chocolate chip cookies, because that's what my husband loves. And I like the fluffy cookies. We have a big debate in our marriage about the kind of cookies we like. And I finally realized you have to melt the butter instead of creaming room temperature butter to make chewy, thin cookies. And once I figured that out, it was like a whole new world. And so it's just, you know, it takes time, but it's really fun.
Yeah, literally food science.
Yeah.
As a side note, I just went on to your Challah of the Week section of your blog and I'm mouthwatering, number one. Number two, how fun in exactly what you were talking about. I brought this up before, where I'm an adjunct lecturer of undergrad and graduate studies, and one of the classes I've taught was global foods, a trip, you know, virtual trip around the world, where we learn about culture and staple foods and also what brings us together. But I love the fact that you tied in, you have Ethiopian sticky buns, and then you have Canadian poutine in the next one, and then you have a different kind of babka. I mean, there's so many great flavors, and this is really a true testament to just having fun in the kitchen and trying different flavors. And for anyone who's not comfortable with making something, what might be a foray in? What could be something that they could do that would be pretty simple, whether it's a savory or a sweet type of dish? What might be the introduction that you might give them as far as guidance is concerned?
Reaching out to someone who grew up making these foods. Like, I'm lucky enough, I made a jerk chicken challah because I'm a wimp when it comes to spice, but I love the taste of jerk chicken. So I'm the one who sits there like crying and just eating it. And one of my best friends is Jamaican. Her mom emigrated from Jamaica in, I believe, the 90s and or late 80s. And her mom's a terrible cook, like really bad. But
name withheld.
But my friend is a great cook, but she doesn't really have access to those Jamaican recipes because she didn't grow up. Her mom didn't grow, you know, she didn't grow up with her mom cooking. And so I called her and I said, okay, I'm making a jerk chicken challah. Like, I don't want to be that white girl who's like, here's a recipe for jerk chicken. Please help. She's like, let me call my cousin. I will get back to you. And so we spent a couple weeks kind of just talking over the phone and, you know, because everyone was virtual. It was over Zoom. She lives in New York. I'm in California. But it was this great connection. And just to hear, you know, I had never really asked her about her family history. And it was so fun to just kind of connect on that level. And then to ultimately come out with a great jerk chicken recipe that I have since used outside of the challah is really great.
So starting off potentially with somebody who could give some guidance and allowing yourself to play around in the kitchen. I also tell people too, because I feel like when we are following recipes and we're going shopping for ingredients, we don't often taste and smell and touch certain things. We just open a can or a jar of something and dumping in, or measure things out and dump it in. And I often tell people, you know, there's such a difference between the fresh versus the dried version of herbs and spices. Open something up and smell and put your finger in there and like taste and say, I think this combination goes pretty well, or that sounds kind of unique. That's something too that I've been doing recently, because I kind of have a culinary background. I'm not at all traditionally or formally trained in at the least, but I have taken a lot of classes and I've been very ingrained in that sort of world since, like you, as early as I can remember, watching television after school and following recipes and such. But I remember looking at the variety of different things that they were putting in, and sometimes things were very simple and plain and it was just like the natural flavors coming out, and other times things had to be drawn out by adding a little bit of something. And just the fact that everything requires a pinch of salt, you know, you're even putting salt in brownies because you're bringing that, you're extracting that flavor out there. So for anyone listening, again, if you're nervous about what to make, okay, if it goes horribly wrong, unfortunately, yeah, you've probably wasted some food, but at least you've tried and you can say, here's what I would do differently, or this is where I'm starting to develop my flavors and develop my talent for this too. And I think scratch cooking as well is one of those things that kind of went away for a really long time, at least I don't want to say like globally, universally speaking, because I haven't done a research study, but in my world, it felt like nobody was cooking anymore. And then flash forward to the pandemic, and then everybody was stuck at home and making, you know, the joke was like banana bread and whatever type of shortbreads you're making and so on. And so I find sometimes there's a catharsis to that. And I don't know if you feel the same way. It sometimes can be a chore when you're slicing, dicing, shopping for things, cleaning up after the fact. But there's also something really sweet about nourishing yourself and creating something or making something for someone, being like, this is handmade for you, or this is a gift I'm giving for myself, or I took the time out of my day to sit there and saute and render things, and I was able to smell and taste. And it just feels really comforting to me to know that that could be a quality or a benefit outside of that too. So as you've developed your skills, do you find that nourishing, cathartic factor to it, or does it seem now to be a little bit more like a chore to you if you have to make something to test out or you have to make something for yourself?
You know, it goes two ways. Like, there are days I'm tired where I'm like, I'm just gonna microwave a Trader Joe's meal and like that'll be it. But there is, you know, in Jewish tradition, there's this really, really great, and I don't know where it started, but there's a great tradition where when you're kneading challah dough, and it has to be 5 pounds or over, and I don't know why, but when you're kneading challah dough, it's supposed to be a really good time to pray for people who need healing. And so you ask people, you know, there's another Instagram friend that I met during COVID who has a challah business in LA. And every week she asks people, you know, in that little sticker on Instagram to send names for prayers of healing. And it's such a, you know, it's just such a comfort and it has that catharsis. And my mother-in-law just a few months ago got sick and passed away very suddenly. And as she was in the hospital, I kind of took a break from Instagram. I wasn't posting and I made one post and said, you know, our family's going through something. Like, if you're making challah, please, you know, include her. And so many of my friends reached out and said, we had a challah bake. We did this and, you know, in her honor. And, you know, ultimately she ended up passing away, but I was able to share that with her. And that was something that was so special because she and I really had a bond over Judaism, like in our synagogue. And it's just something that, it's, I don't even have the words to describe like how cool that is and just how, you know, people I didn't know were reaching out and saying, you know, we made challah, we kept her in our prayers. And like there, it's that communal aspect of, they don't know me, but they're trying to help.
First of all, my condolences to you and your family, but you gave me chills just now because of the fact of keeping someone in mind, but also like you said, complete strangers or a community outside of what your close circle would be that would be able to do something like that for you and to be able to integrate that in your last discussions with her as well, just to say people around this, you know, virtual space that we have are thinking of you and are putting their thoughts and prayers together as they're also integrating that custom and that tradition of making the challah bread to you. I love stories like that in the sense of while it was sad, there was still that component of it that is just so gleeful and joyful and comforting too. And that's also something that I feel we should focus a little bit more on when it comes to the way that we interact and engage with people on the internet and really support people who are maybe going through times that, unlike you, might not be sharing that information. And we don't know what everybody's experiences are. So thank you for being vulnerable, for reaching out, asking for support when it was needed, and being able to receive that too. That's beautiful, Marissa. Thank you. So let's jump ahead a little bit. Bring us into your school years too, because you mentioned earlier, and I can't remember if this was our pre-conversation or in our intro section, you talked a little bit about history, your history major, mm-hmm. and how that also maybe influenced where you are now. So walk us through a little bit more in the more recent years of how all of this kind of plays a role together.
Yeah. So I'm still exploring kind of how it all goes together. But yeah, I was a history major, and, you know, I was lucky enough. I went to a very big school. I went to University of Michigan, and we were lucky enough to kind of, as a history major, be able to choose a concentration within history. And so mine, not that this is much of a concentration, but it was Jewish history. So in every history class I took, I was able to kind of find that Jewish element to write a paper about or to do a project on. It was fascinating. It kind of gave me this sense of, you can fall into the, I'm going to use the word trap, but that's probably not the right word, of, you know, Jews are all white. Jews are all of Eastern European descent. And that's not true. Like, there are Jews all over the world of all different colors from everywhere. And it was so mind-opening to be able to just explore those communities in college. And, you know, then obviously moving to LA, like, we have a huge Persian Jewish population, which I never really experienced before. And it's a whole other kind of Judaism. It's, you know, it ties in a lot of like Middle Eastern cultural elements, and it's really cool. And I felt I needed to explore it more and explore not only the different kinds of Judaism, but just the world and just different kinds of people. And I've always been one to, you know, I make fast friends. I love talking to people, and it just seemed, you know, people always want to talk about food, always want to talk about their culture, always want to talk about tradition. And it's just an easy in. It's, you know, you can so easily start talking to people. But even within Judaism, you know, when I started the blog and the Instagram and all of that, it brought me people from all different denominations of Judaism. And that also is fascinating. Like, I was talking on Instagram with Orthodox women in Israel, and here I am, like, a reform / conservative woman in California. Like, it's just fascinating. And it's also, you know, there's the aspect of the continuation of tradition, you know, with my professional background up until very recently has been in Holocaust education. And so the continuation of traditions and is so important, especially with my grandma being a survivor herself, of, you know, these were things that they were trying to wipe out, these recipes, this culture. And so to be now, you know, I'm what now, third generation, like, to be someone who still has these recipes is so powerful and is still making them.
As you were speaking, as I always do, I take a ton of notes and things. And so I wanted to capture a few things. Number one, whether it's education or career, profession, etc., I really do believe there's something unique about what we call sometimes niching down or specializing in something, because people tend to get this concept of, oh, then I'm whittling down to, like, you know, one human person, I'll have something to talk about. But really, when you do niche down or you look deeper into something a little bit more specialized, it actually opens up a wider world. Like you said, there's so much diversity even within the Jewish traditional faith, culture, etc. The people of all these regions across the globe who follow Jewish paths, but also in their own ways, like you said, Orthodox, Reformed, etc. And so I find that if you are given guidance when you're going through your college years or when you're starting a career of, you know, just generalizing something, while that's good because you could still be able to speak to the masses and have, like, a little bit of understanding about everything, I really do think there's some benefit in learning a little bit more about something specific, because then you become the expert in that. And that's a very unique stance to take, whether you look at it towards a desirability of applying to a job that no one else has that specialty in, or just being able to, like, come up with these really interesting conversation pieces. The other thing too that you mentioned was exactly that of speaking to people like me. I mean, I don't know. There's, like, something introverted extrovert about me sometimes too. Like, I joke that I hug strangers, but if you put me in a room with a large crowd, I need to go hide in the closet somewhere. It just freaks me out when there's, like, a mass of people, especially now. There's, like, a mass of people. I get really unnerved, but I'm very chatty and I like asking a ton of questions. And that's something that I think also relies on some fearlessness too, that you don't mind asking questions that might sometimes feel uncomfortable, but as I say, uncomfortable but necessary conversations to have. So as I mentioned earlier, with the class that I teach, I'm in New York City. It is a very diverse, culturally diverse and other diverse area. And in my classes, I think it's very rare to find an American-born white person in the classroom. So as the teacher, a lot of times I'm like, what the heck do I know about any of these things? I want everyone else to share their lived experience. And there's so much value that comes from asking people about their background, about what their take is on stuff, how they grew up, whether or not they think, because culturally speaking, sometimes there's a lot of, let me see if I can be kind of respectful about this, but there's, like, you know, wives' tales and things that are going on in how, just how life was done back in the day, where, like, your grandma would put some kind of concoction on you and, like, cure whatever you had. That's not exactly science-based evidence, but it's what worked back then, or whatever belief system or health belief system, because there is a lot to say about things like traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic practices and all these other kind of, like, Eastern modalities that we just don't recognize in the Western world, because we're very, you know, pharmaceutical based and modern medicine. And while all of those things obviously play a role, there's a very broader amount of information, education, experiences out there that sometimes if we're just myopic and we stick to our circle and we all know what we just know and that's it, and we don't venture out to try Kentucky Fried Chicken or an Ethiopian restaurant or talk to people who are quote unquote strangers on the internet, you know, we don't allow ourselves to broaden that scope of that. So I love that you have this role that you're doing that is almost like started out as like a hobby, but it is part of your persona. And now it's broadening into being able to contribute to much broader sense, both on the giving and the receiving end of it. Like you're allowing yourself to get all this information from outsiders and you're also sharing information and again, bringing everyone together. I love that, Marissa.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I will say a lot of it, I think, you know, I can attribute to my upbringing in Chicago. You know, Chicago also is a very, very, very diverse city. And I have these memories of, you know, my dad taking me in. So there's a street in Chicago called Devon. And on one side, it's completely Indian and Pakistani. And on the other side, it's completely Orthodox Jewish kosher. And I remember going, I mean, I don't even know how little I was, like 5 or 6. And we'd go to the Indian buffet for lunch. And then we'd walk across the street to the kosher bakery and, you know, get like a little piece of cake or something that was so familiar. And it's that to me is just a memory that's always stuck in my mind of that one street and just being so drastically different on each side. But like being some of the best meals I've ever had.
And I really hope that even if people who are not necessarily in a diverse population, there's got to be something. Like you probably have a downtown area or on the outskirts of something, or maybe within 30 to 60 minutes drive away from you or a train ride away from you, you can experience some other things. And I think that also helps broaden no matter what age we are. So, you know, we talk a lot of times about, as you had, and as I had too, of exposing children to a variety of different flavors and techniques and allowing children in the kitchen and playing a role in creation of foods, and then also allowing them to experience outside cultures or whatever it is, even if you go shopping for things. I know I've said this before in some of my past episodes where my grandmother would take me on the bus and we would go to the pork store, the cheese store, the fish store. We didn't go to like one giant supermarket. And there's something fun about that too. Like you said, you kind of have the across the street, you're trying one experience and then next to that, you have something else. That is actually not so much a resolution, but a goal that I have for myself for this year is to be a lot more hands-on and get out there. I've definitely been a little bit worried and concerned about health issues, obviously, because we're still, what is this going on, year 4 now of the pandemic. And I've been a little bit of a homebody, but almost to the point where it's like, okay, come on, like how much stuff am I getting delivered to my apartment? That's also just not environmentally friendly either. But there's something about going out there and engaging and being part of your community. And then something that I just don't feel like I've had time to do between going back to school and then kind of hitting the ground running with business stuff. And as you were talking with that, I'm really grateful. I'm grateful that we have so much stuff nearby, that I do have little India across the street. I have little Poland, you know, bus ride or a train ride away. I have all these different areas, little Greek, little Astoria, you know, up in Queens, Greece, mm-hmm. Greek culture and Greek community there. So many different things to play with and to experience and to enjoy.
But, you know, I'm a morning person. I'm an early riser. I, you know, make a cup of coffee. If I'm testing a recipe or doing something like that, usually it's in the morning before work, because I like being up. You know, there's this peace you get when it's quiet and no one else is really awake except for our cat who's running laps around our house. That time of day to me is so peaceful. And there is something a little bit meditative about, you know, waking up. I can go upstairs in my pajamas. I don't have to see anybody, and just working on a recipe. But we're coming up on the Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat, which is, we call it the birthday of the trees. And it actually started as a harvesting holiday. But there's the seven species that we eat on Tu B'Shvat. And it's, I'm going to not be able to name all of them, but it's like barley, wheat, olives, dates, figs, pomegranates. And there's one more that I'm totally forgetting, but this is always my favorite holiday to come up with recipes for, because one, they're always healthier because you're using all of these fruits and, you know, sweetening something with date or date syrup, you know, it's not going to have all of that necessarily added processed sugar. So I find it more of a challenge and more of a puzzle and more rewarding because I eat a lot of sugar in what I do. And so it's always a nice reset to kind of think about like, okay, this is fruit. This is, you know, and I love dates, which is ironic because that is my married name. But they're so versatile. And it's one of those connections of like, these have been used since ancient times all over the world. And like, look at what I can create with them now. And it's really fun.
I was going to say, first of all, it was meant to be, if dates are dates. And secondly, yeah, dates are huge across. Well, I know in the studies I share with my students, it's mostly focused a lot of times on the Middle Eastern cultures where they break the fast of using dates. And it's also a very versatile plant. So they use it from the leaves, the palm fronds of the date palm plant itself to the dates. And like you said, it can be used in a variety of different ways, to use as a sweetener. And I know even a savory way too, like goat cheese stuffed dates. Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, I love stuff, yeah. love stuff like that.
Yeah.
A great, great fruit. So Marissa, where do you see some of this going then down the line for you? You mentioned a little bit. Can we tease a little bit about maybe potentially a cookbook in the works at some point? Hopefully. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about where you see this going. Is this going to be a side gig or will this be a full-time gig at some point, whether it's 2 to 5 to 10 years? You tell us.
Yeah, you know, I have this ultimate goal of one day being on the Food Network, but who knows? Who knows how long? You know, I grew up not far actually from where, I don't know if you know Molly Yeh, but she has a show on the Food Network. She mixes. She's half Chinese and half Jewish, and I find her fascinating and just. We're similar in a lot of ways. And I actually grew up down the street from where she grew up. And so she's like I aspire to be similar to what she does. But you know, that's a 10, 15, 20 years down the line goal. But you know, in the meantime, it's something I do for fun. You know, it's never really been something like I've never been really trying to monetize it to do any of that. It's, you know, it's fun. It's connection, it's personal, and that's the fulfillment I get. That being said, I am in the process of trying to find someone to publish a cookbook. It's all written, it's all drafted, but we're just trying to find a publisher, so we will keep you updated on that process.
I think that's fantastic because not everything has to be your go-to gig. You can have things that you do quote unquote on the side, whether it's baking or knitting or crafts of some sort or whatever, handiwork, whatever it is. But if there's enough things that you are putting out, not just you, Marissa, anyone who's listening to this too, that you're putting out in the world and you do feel like you're the go-to person, that when people come to you, they're constantly asking the same thing over and over again. I feel like it's almost a not requirement, but it would be a wonderful way to serve the broader population for you to make a resource that is much more globally accessible, whether it is, I mean, you have the blog, so not, you know, that's a first start for anybody. Throw some stuff together. It's a vlog or a blog or, you know, a diary that exists online that people nowadays too, with search engines and keywords and tags, people can find you. And of course, you know, using social media in a variety of different ways as well could be just documenting a place and a space that you have in this planet that otherwise would go unnoticed. I think it's one of those things that would be lovely for everybody to share whatever gift they have. But of course, I also recognize that you don't want to give some things away sometimes, and that's also okay. You're allowed to just keep that to yourself, let that be the thing that you take with you, and it's very personal and private, and that's also okay. What are some of the go-to resources that if people are interested in learning more about not just maybe Jewish heritage, but recipes, things like that, what are some of the things that you enjoy looking at, reading? Do you go to conferences? Do you do anything on that broader scale too? Are there certain, you know, YouTube channels or food shows like you mentioned as well with Rachel Ray and Molly Yeh? Anything like that that you might want to share as far as go-to resources, aside from your own links, which I will make sure I include in this episode?
I'm a big proponent of anything Food Network. Like just sitting and watching the cooking shows is how I learned, and being in the kitchen with my grandmother and my mother. I will say Ina Garten is my go-to. I love her. Her recipes are so easy And they're, you know, for anyone who has kind of a trepidation of I'm not a baker or I'm not a cook, her recipes are so easily accessible and so just easy to make that I think she's a great way to, you know, her recipes are a great way to start. We make, for Passover, we make coconut macaroons every year. My grandma does. And, you know, they're one of my favorite cookies. I like only make them on Passover because otherwise I would literally eat all of them all year. And I asked her when I was doing the blog, I said, you know, can I have the recipe? I'd love to share it with people. She said, yeah, Google Ina Garten macaroon recipe. And I said, oh, I thought this was yours.
You just reminded me, if anybody watches the TV show Friends, of an episode where Phoebe Buffay is trying to figure out her grandmother's secret chocolate chip cookie recipe. And it's from Nestle Tollhouse, which is the Nestle Tollhouse chocolate chip recipe on the back of the bag. So funny that happens. I'm trying to think if there's anything that my family, my mom always used to have hand-me-down recipes, and then she would finesse them a little bit too. But my mom right now in her new stage of life is also continuing to being inspired. She loves Molly Yeh, loves watching the, I think Lydia Bastianich is one of her favorite ones as well, where she loves watching just because of the Italian heritage and the very natural types of foods that Lydia puts together. And she's still inspired by things. So even though she suffers from a variety of different chronic conditions, and there's also certain things that she just doesn't enjoy the flavor of, she'll mix and match some stuff, or she'll try her hand at, I guess, you know, kind of like improvising or freestyling and being, again, being inspired by. So that's something too. I don't necessarily think, I mean, I guess once you get familiar and comfortable with cooking and even baking for that matter too, you can, the listener, us as well, we can be more comfortable with playing around with certain things, right? Like if somebody doesn't like broccoli, they might want to switch it out with a different kind of green vegetable or a different vegetable altogether. If they don't like the way that almonds taste, then maybe they can try a different kind of nut or use a different kind of flavoring. So that's something too, that you can take traditional recipes, you can also take things that you've been inspired by from the internet, from television shows, from cookbooks, etc., and still make something that is uniquely yours. So I really encourage everybody to go out and play with their food and learn a little bit more too about where certain things come from, the heritage behind the scenes there as well. And I think you've given a lot of information for us to really process and take with us and hopefully inspire us too, Marissa. I really appreciate your time here. So let me finish with my final two questions, my two-part question, which is, what is on your plate today, both figuratively and literally? So after we wrap up, what is it that you're working on next? And then what are you eating or making for yourself as your next meal?
On the plate is finding a publisher. That is my big, it's been a year-long process and we're still going. So, but also, you know, working, you know, when my mother-in-law got sick, it was kind of a break, and I'm just now starting to get back to really creating new recipes. And so look out for a lot of new, fun, creative baking recipes in the next couple of months. Our freezer is full of baked goods. And then, you know, what's on my plate today? We're actually down in San Diego for the weekend. And there is a great Jewish deli that we are going to for lunch. And I am very excited to get my, so I think it's like really a Midwestern soup, but it's called mishmash. And it's chicken broth in like a gigantic bowl. And it has rice, noodles, matzo balls, and kreplach, which are meat filled dumplings. And it's just like a hug in a bowl. Like it's so nostalgic, but it's totally Jewish. It has like every Jewish soup in it. And I didn't realize that people outside of the Midwest, I don't think, know what it is. Like I posted about it on Instagram, and this woman who follows me who lives in Louisiana said, oh, I've only ever had that in Ohio. I was like, oh, like not it's a uniquely Midwestern Jewish dish. And so to be able to find it in San Diego is very exciting.
I was going to say the term mishmash or mishmash, sometimes depending on where you read it or hear it from, does mean that, like a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And I was, as you're talking, as I tend to do, I'm looking it up online, and somebody termed it as the most outrageous soup because it has a little bit of everything. That's the whole point of it. I love that. Well, enjoy your meal. Enjoy your time where you are. congratulations on all of these things that you have kind of in the hopper. We're going to, you know, hopefully put out there in the universe, in the hands of whoever's listening, to pick up something to make that dream come true. And I look forward to seeing you on the Food Network one day.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me this week on the Dish with Dina podcast. I am Dina D'Alessandro, registered dietitian, nutritionist, founder, and chief executive life changer at Dish with Dina, and I'm also your host. If you like what you heard, I would be so grateful if you could subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, and share this with others who you think might benefit from what we have to offer on these episodes. You can also join my mailing list at dishwithdina.com or email me at info@dishwithdina.com with questions, comments, feedback, and if you'd like to be a guest on a future episode, because everybody eats and we all have a story to share. I hope you tune back in next week when we dish again.